Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue learning. We need to continue praying. We need to continue getting up off our knees and taking the paradigm that it all depends on us, because it really does, folks. We have to be the ambassadors for him and his Constitution. He will not save nations. He gave us this nation. He gave us this Constitution. It is our job to save what he gave us. He is only cares, and he's only cared about, you know, the salvation of mankind, which is why we have our Lord and Savior. But did he not bless us with a government that actually protects us from all of the things that we're being thrown into? Absolutely. So what would it take? And as a matter of fact, this is, I've said this again, I'm blue in the face on this one. When we look at where we are, only he knew we would be here. It was pretentious of John Adams to say that this Constitution was written only for a good, righteous people. Well, it seems more apropos that it was written for us today than it was for them. If you understand what I just said, then you can see the divine hand of providence and how the 14th Amendment became that final piece, because out of all of the different amendments, only the 14th Amendment gave us teeth in taking back this Constitution that the Constitution was lacking itself. The framers didn't even realize that they needed to actually put real teeth into the Constitution, because they were living in a paradigm that the honor and integrity of a man was more than adequate to keeping people in check. Ergo, we now have such a corrupt government. And this is why we have this, I'll just say, they play this game of honor amongst thieves. Why they won't, and they refuse to hold them accountable, which is why every one of our petitions demand that we get our legislators at the county and state level to finally empower the people to remove them when they violate their oath of office in accordance to the law. Again, this is all about the full compliance. See, I'm just getting better and better trying to get this through this obligatory to point out this is a movement in demanding full compliance to their oaths of office. They are our government. The government are not these buildings. They're not the flags that sit on top of the buildings. Our government are our representatives, not the judges, not even the executives. Our government are the representatives, because we have a government that is Republican in form. And ergo, we were talking about the Supremacy Clause, and we actually just covered that Supremacy Clause and kind of dove into this one thing that we were, you know, Sean brought up, because he asked about Article 6 and the states, or I should say, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state. So anything within the Constitution of a state or the laws of any state that are contrary, notwithstanding. In other words, they can't be contrary. They can't make anything in their state constitution or in their laws that are contrary to the U.S. Constitution. And so we have the final section, subsection, or whatever, of Article 6. And Tammy, I think it's your turn. And so welcome back, welcome back, Tammy, and welcome back, Sean.
Great to be here.
Okay. So, Tammy, what say you?
Okay. All right. The senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States.
Okay, so it created an absolute negative right there that you could not apply any religious test for anybody serving in a position of trust
or public, an office or public trust under the Constitution, or I should say under the U.S. government. But to be clear, it says that they all should be bound by oath or affirmation to support. This is the interesting part, and I should capitalize this. This Constitution. Do you think the divine hand of providence is so omnipotent that he even knew that there would be another Constitution? Sean, what do you think? Yeah. Do you think he knew that there would actually be an abominational constitution that was an abomination to this Constitution? Now, you may be muted, and I would love to have everybody benefit from what you're saying, but go ahead.
Of course he did.
Okay. I believe he knew. I believe he knew everything. I believe he really knew what we were going to fight, because I don't think it's a coincidence that to support this Constitution, you know, it may have been logical for the framers to not think, you know, oh, well, the states will be constituted, so we'd have to support this Constitution over the state. But I honestly think that when we look at it today, we look at it as this Constitution in contrast to the abomination, what we call the annotated Constitution, what the courts have created their own Constitution. This goes back to how we've been talking about this judiciary form of government. The courts have created their own Constitution and given them the full latitude of how they want to interpret every line of the Constitution and how they want to enforce it. So, that covers Article 6. We finally got here, folks. We're at the very, very end. So, Article 7, this is where I say, if we really look at the construction of the Constitution, folks, we just covered the sixth article. The sixth day of creating, you know, his view of how we should be governing ourselves. And on the seventh, or in the seventh article, or on that seventh day, he rested. And in this particular case, he rested the power of this Constitution in the hands of the parties to it by ensuring that he identified that they would be the authorizing parties to create this Constitution and to create this government, which is what that word ratification means. Ratification, by legal definition way back then and today, is the same. It is the formal acceptance to a contract or compact or treaty. Go look it up, folks. That is what that word means. So therefore, the ratification of the Convention of Nine States, not the Supreme Court, not the president, not Congress, nine states, shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states so ratifying. In other words, by these nine states ratifying, they did dismantle the Articles of Confederation and those states that wanted to stay with that. What they did was they basically said, with nine states accepting this, you can move forward with this Constitution and actually create the federal government and those things that are within this Constitution. Does that all make sense? So, and I know I kind of presented this to you before, Sean, regarding, you know, the sixth and the seventh. But to me, it clicks. I mean, this all from the Supremacy Clause and all these other things, as we've gone through them, how can we not see his DNA in this? How can we not see this underlying tone of the value of liberty in the governance of mankind? And the importance of it, you know, what ends up happening, and this has been the failures of government from the very beginning, and why we never learned our lesson. And as a matter of fact, Aristotle was the mentor for Alexander the Great. I'm not sure if that, you know, that literally just clicked in your head. Alexander the Great, who was the man that was conquering the world, was a protege to Aristotle. In other words, he sought guidance and information and understanding from this Greek philosopher, this, you know, this pretty wise guy, who was wrong on science in many ways, right? And so Alexander the Great, and you'll actually get this from my book, and I think I cite this out of J.M. Roberts' History of the World, Part 1 or Part 2 or whatever. It's the citations there. But J.M. Roberts basically reported that in one of the many conversations that Alexander the Great had with Aristotle, is he wanted to understand why mankind constantly gravitated towards a autocratic or statist form of government. And so Aristotle kind of threw this in, and I think this is where the progressives kind of realized where they needed to attack. The nucleus of society has always been the family. That is the nucleus of society. And so when people look, and when, you know, you get enough families of people together into an area where they finally decide that we need to have a relationship, agreeable relationship of how we're going to act with each other. In other words, they start forming a government. And it is very conceited that we think that we can apply this concept of ruling a family, a patriarchal, you know, structure, into a government, where you end up either creating a monarchy or you create this democracy or statism under democracy, because you go down these two specific paths. Both of them will lead to tyranny, because when you go down the statist path, you've created a group of people that know better than you do how you need to live your life. Or you go down the path of a family who are obviously better than everybody else in society, and they will govern and rule you to serve themselves. So you see that the family creates, you know, these different forms of government that lend to themselves in applying the family model to government, where it doesn't work at that level. We can't create these classes of people. As a matter of fact, there's all these different, you know, if you look at the caste system, you know, and all these other governments that have gone down these different paths of trying to, you know, create these classifications. These people are better. These people are, that's every person should be entitled to their own sovereignty and to make their own decisions. This concept of liberty was always void in every process throughout history in creating government. But here's the interesting thing. In 1215, the land barons of England recognized that the people had inalienable rights, that they needed to have these rights protected, and that the only way they could protect them was by creating a negative, like a Bill of Rights, against the king. Or get the king to abide by or create an acknowledgement that the people had these rights. So that created the Magna Carta. Folks, this was a huge paradigm shift that actually impacted Britain, or not Britain, but Europe, and more specifically the Germanic states. Because when you look at what these 25 land barons did in petitioning the king, well, they didn't petition him with a piece of paper academically. They petitioned him with swords. These 25 men drew their swords on the king, and they overpowered him. And they commenced to have this long, let's just say, this long convention, this long counseling session of what their demands were. And the king ultimately basically signed the Magna Carta. And so, because it was, you know, they were fed up. They weren't going to allow this to continue. And they were willing to kill the king and accept whoever the next, because this is the paradigm. I want you to understand this as well. That if they killed the king, that didn't create an open, no government. There was somebody that was going to be the successor of the king that would be the next ruler. They believed, even though they were challenging individual liberty, they weren't in the position or paradigm at this point in time in 1215 that they would challenge God's hand in the government of England or Britain. What I just said is they had this paradigm that God had selected this class of this lineage of people that they were appointed to lead Britain. So they were still embracing that one concept. But they were standing up and saying, you righteous anointed monarchs over the land and the people of Britain, you need to give us these rights. You need to give us and recognize, you know, that we have a right to assemble. We have a right to petition you, so forth and so on. So does that make sense, Tammy and Sean? Are we kind of at that point?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so Sean, I could barely hear you. What did you just say?
I said yes, sir.
Oh, okay, thank you. Now, you don't have to say yes, sir. You say, yeah, or actually, are these things that we've ever learned in history?
Not in school.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Not in school, because it doesn't support the narrative. And the only way we can actually learn this stuff is actually by going through these artifacts and documents and start looking at the macro and seeing how all of these things came together. Because actually what these land barons did was they kind of inspired Martin Luther to actually petition the church with these 95 theses, just like the land barons petitioned King John over their problems. I don't think they had them necessarily written down, but the byproduct was written down in the Magna Carta. And so as we kind of look at what these guys did, they galvanized in the history of mankind that the people actually had these rights. And so later on, as the monarchs and everything else started going sideways and they, you know, started violating the rights and so forth, what ended up happening was there was this huge revolution in the 1600s while America was being founded and formed and shaped in these states that were actually being established. Britain went through a bloody revolution, and it was called the Glorious Revolution, where they got the Glorious Bill of Rights. The Glorious Bill of Rights was an affirmation of the Magna Carta. And in the Glorious Bill of Rights, they maintained the right of assembly and petitioning. So when it came time in America to move forward, after we broke away from Britain under the Articles of Confederation, this Continental Congress, and it was Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and all these people in the original Continental Congress that basically says we need to import those rights into America. And Bob Schultz kind of keeps captured this right of petitioning, and the fact what they did, because, folks, if you read the right of petition in the Magna Carta, it's in chapter 61. Actually, it's paragraph 61, not chapter, because really, if you look at each chapter, it's just really a paragraph. So anyway, it's in the 61st paragraph of the Magna Carta, and this is where the king basically acknowledges that if the people petition him for the redress of grievances, because in their government, it's a monarch, so they petition their government, the monarch, for redress of grievances. In America, we petition our government, the representatives, because even in Continental Congress, it's representative in form, right? They didn't have an executive. It was the representatives. They didn't have a judiciary. It was the representatives. And when they broke it up, we still have representatives. So who do we see when we petition government? Our representatives. Anyway, so what Thomas Jefferson basically stated, I think it was Benjamin Franklin that says, well, hold on here. The king, basically, if he came forward and says, if he has not redressed the grievances within 40 days, his entire kingdom is theirs until he does. That's the language of the Magna Carta. So I want to put it out there that these guys actually had this conversation because they said, you know, we're not going to have a government that's going to possess anything. The government is basically going to be serving the states. They're the ones that possess everything. They possess the property. They possess the production and means of, you know, of the money, our economy, and so forth. We are just here to serve them. So how are we going to actually put teeth in the right of the petition? Do either of you know what the teeth were when they actually finally decided how to integrate the right of petition? Either of you know? I take that was a no. Is that a dual no? You don't know. Okay, so Bob Schultz, that's fine. Bob Schultz with the We the People Foundation has made this in his extracts of that historical process. He pointed out that it was Thomas Jefferson that came out and said this, that even though the government doesn't possess anything, because we the people possess the wealth of the nations now. We the people, we the states possess this. So the federal government or this general government, the Continental Congress, we the people, in other words, if we petitioned them for the redress of grievances and they failed to redress our grievances, they maintain that similar paradigm or that same language in inserting this into the Continental Congress, that if they fail to redress the grievances, then we no longer have to pay taxes. In other words, I think it was Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin, one of the two, that made the logical leap. Well, if government is oppressing us and we're petitioning them for the redress of grievances, then we shouldn't have to pay them taxes anymore to pay for their oppression. And that's how we can get them to stop oppressing us, because, you know, that will be the teeth. And that makes, to me, that's, that makes sense. Absolutely, it does make sense. And so Bob Schultz has made a long pursuit and career, and God bless this man. He's really helped me kind of see, you know, in the Republic Review and all the other things I did, how integral what he was doing was a huge part of this. And so he's made his lifelong pursuit in trying to restore the teeth of petitions, that we don't have to pay taxes. So right, wrong, or indifferent, he felt that that had to be done, because until we actually have teeth in the petitioning, we can't succeed. I believe that the only way we're going to succeed, that this is in conflict, or I see it a little bit differently than Bob. And again, I love the guy. And just because I see it differently doesn't mean I feel any different. I believe that the only way we the people are going to be able to be successful, just like with Martin Luther, is not about having teeth in holding the Catholic Church accountable. Getting the people to actually make their decision to either force, and they knew they couldn't go to war against the Catholic Church. So what they ended up doing was they actually ended up going after the people and saying, hey, we need to reform and break away from the church and reform Christianity. So in this like and in this manner, I believe that the power is in the people. The only way we're going to restore those teeth is for the people to demand that. The only way we're going to actually implement holding our public servants accountable is for we the people to demand it. And I believe, like we said in yesterday's, you know, show, I believe the people of Wyoming could actually lead the union. I believe that the people of Wyoming, South Dakota, Iowa, and the rest of these dark red states that are, you know, throughout the flyover states, isn't it amazing how just a few very sparsely populated states can have such an impact on these heavily populated states? If you really think about it, and you count, you know, the amount of representation and everything else throughout those big states, you know, you take the top four or five, and you go, wow, I mean, that's a lot. And then you take these other, you know, interior states, and you go, wow, it takes a lot of states to kind of come up to that amount. That's the beautiful thing about a republic, though, because each state has its own voice. When you look at, when you finally get the states, the parents together, this is one of the reasons why James Madison basically said, hey, they're the parties to the compact. And the only way that you're going to get leverage, unfortunately, over the federal government is you have to have a majority of the states controlling both houses. Why? Because you don't need to have a two-thirds majority. You don't need 60%. You only need 50% plus one. So when you count up, and I think I did the math last time, it's 27 states that will have enough states based on the, because Texas is a part of this. Florida is a part of this. They're the two big, heavily populated states. So because we have a couple of the big populated states, it kind of tilts some advantages in our favor, which is why we only need 27 states to obtain full control over Congress, because when you add the representation, you only need to have a majority. You don't have to have a supermajority or anything else. So anyway, we're going into break. And so when we come back, we're actually going to go dive into the Bill of Rights, because there's a lot of other little things that are in here. And there's one thing that I'm going to point out before we get into the preamble of the Bill of Rights. And then we're going to really start heading through the Bill of Rights and the rest of the amendments. And, you know, before the end of the year, we'll be done here. Anyway, God bless. We'll be right back, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Sean, so Tammy, let me ask you a question. How many times have you heard, because I've actually heard this come up in many of the Charlie Kirk conversations, how many times have you heard people say, well, God is not mentioned in our Constitution?
I heard people say that, but I don't agree with that.
Okay, well, that's okay.
It's right in the preamble.
So just like, you know, arguments and so forth, when you understand the Constitution and you'll get it right, but I've heard it several times. I've actually seen a few different dialogues where Charlie Kirk has basically gone down the same path of answering that question. Why, you know, he doesn't defend that God is mentioned in the Constitution because it is. He is. As a matter of fact, we're going to do that before we get into this. The fact of the matter is, you know, he points to the state constitution, and it's good that he does that. But the fact that most people miss this happens way too often. So 9 times out of 10, when we read the Constitution, we end at Article 7. Now, Tammy, would you please read the line that says, done in convention by unanimous consent of the states. Read that entire four lines there, okay?
Starting with done?
Done in convention by the unanimous consent.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states present, the 17th day of September in the year of our Lord, 1787, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 12th, and witness whereof we have hereunto subscribed our names.
There you go. So it doesn't mention God? This was done in the year of their Lord. They were in the service of him in doing this. Right? You see my point? You know, it may not be listed in the articles itself, but they actually added to make sure everybody knew that they did this in serving him in his year. Now, it's right. Unfortunate that we don't use that same language in the year of our Lord 2025. But they sure did, and they were surely doing this in his service, because the actual preamble basically is saying so that we can secure, you know, for our prosperity, right? So let's now dive into the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights, this is the third preamble in the Constitution. The first one is actually labeled as the preamble. The second one is the Uniformity Clause, which is the very beginning of Article 1, Section 8. They created a preamble to help explain why only the following powers were being delegated to Congress to be able to do their job. And so this is the third preamble. And so, Sean, why don't you read those three lines?
The conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added.
Okay, so again, interesting vernacular. We don't use don't speak like that these days. But what is this Bill of Rights doing? It's establishing so that there won't be any abuse of federal powers. It's establishing restrictive clauses. In other words, these restrictive clauses are not giving the court an ability to start creating laws and regulations regarding these. These are restrictions. You can't go here. Don't meddle with this stuff. Don't talk about it. Don't even look at it. That's right. Get your eyes away from there. You know, I mean, if you've seen people when they've, you know, kind of, if you want to say bullied or, you know, stood in authority to, don't even look at that. We've seen that in movies or what have you. And that's one of the metaphors I like using, as well as shooting people's feet, you know, making people dance and so forth. Because sometimes you got to use force to get people to do things. So anyway.
Here it's like clauses for dummies, basically.
Yeah, so, right. So here we have the Bill of Rights being injected as declaratory restrictive clauses. These are the things you can't meddle with. Okay, so the very first article, which was never ratified, and actually I need to change that, and I need to insert the article, so I need to do this. I just asked both of you to try to make sure that I do this, because I need to cite that article regarding Connecticut ratifying this to basically say this was actually ratified and Connecticut is withholding their ratification still to this day. But this is very important because this is the First Amendment, right, of the Bill of Rights, and it's not what you call the First Amendment. But more importantly, this amendment, we learn more about the apportionment and the restrictiveness that Congress can't touch it. Madison knew that if Congress could regulate that number of 30,000, he wouldn't need to make an amendment. We're talking about the father of the Constitution. Why would he create an amendment that would not be necessary? Ergo, he knew that the only way you could actually adjust that 30,000 in Article 1, Section 2 is through this amendment. So, Tammy, why don't you read that first part of where there shall be 100 representatives, nor less than one representative for every 40,000 persons, get to that point.
Okay.
It's almost over halfway through. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. There shall be one representative for every 30,000 until the number shall amount to 100, after which the proportion shall be so regulated by Congress that there shall be not less than 100 representatives, nor less than one representative for every 40,000 persons.
Okay, so it's clear that he made an adjustment that once they had 100 representatives in Congress, that it would make the adjustment to 40,000. Now, Sean, read the following part. Right. Go ahead.
Amendment?
No. The article, the first article, it is... Oh. Halfway through, actually, so if you go down 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth line where it starts off 40,000 persons.
Okay.
Now, just go ahead and reach until the number of representatives shall amount to 200.
Until the amount of representatives shall amount to 200, after which the proportion shall be so regulated by Congress that there shall not be less than 200 representatives, nor more than one representative for every 50,000 persons.
Okay, so in other words, once they hit 200, then the magical number changes to 60, or to 50,000, I'm sorry, and it caps at 50. In other words, Madison saw a way to making sure that representation would be maintained very calculated in a manner based on the growth of Congress, right? So yours truly actually captured the history of all of this. And so where is it? It's right here. And so when we look at the apportionment or how many people were sitting in Congress. When they hit 100 representatives, right? So I'm looking at 1790, they had 65. And in the first article going into, going into the Bill of Rights, they would have actually maintained 30,000 until the next census, where they jumped into 142. So in 1800, they actually started the next session with 142 representatives. Had this amendment been in play, then what would have happened is they would have actually changed from 30 to 40,000, which would have brought that 142 down significantly to probably just a little over 100. And when they hit the 200 representatives, that was in the 4th Congress, or in 1820. And so they kept on growing till 1900. Now, just keep in mind that when they built Congress, based on the 30,000, when they built Congress, they built it for 435 representatives in the body of the House of Representatives. So in other words, they seat all 435 in the big body for both Congress and the Senate and all of that, for them all to sit there. That's because that's the House that the House of Representatives sits in. When everybody comes to do the State of the Union and everything else, they all have their seats, where the Senate sits in these seats, the Supreme Court sits in these seats, so forth and so on. So it's all in that House where they have 435 seats. They reached the 435th seat in 1910. So in other words, Congress finally got to a point where they started having to play the game of marginalizing or minimizing, you know, this representation to a degree that totally got out of hand. Now, one of the things that they did, because when we talked about this the other day, Sean, I don't know if, Tammy, you were part of this. I don't think you were. When they talked about representation, 30,000 people, out the gate, I believe they were looking at just people, period, persons. Down the road, I believe that they started realizing that, hey, you can't count kids slaves if they're not slaves. You can't count children and so forth. So they wanted to make sure that they were age-ready or capable of representation. So there was an age limit that they had for representation. And they made an adjustment at that point to say, it's not, you know, a child isn't entitled to representation. Their representation is their parent. And until they become an adult, then that's what the holdup is. So they started, this wasn't games, this is how they started cleaning up and better defining what representation was. Because it does fly in the face of our world today that a baby could demand representation, because in so doing, a child could actually start taking legal action against their parents, right? And that would fly in the face of parental rights, family, and so forth. So, anywho, as we look at the time span, what Madison basically put in play and what they created in the House of Congress, it actually survived our republic all the way till the 12th session, which was 1900 to basically 1910. And so in 1910 is when they filled up the 435th seats. And from that point on, they started actually playing, and it was in 1929, which is basically the subsequent decade after they filled up the 435 seats, where they did the Reapportionment Act, where Congress said, we have full control over this number, and don't worry about it. We'll take it from here. Because technically, I believe that had we gotten to a point where Congress basically had to amend the Constitution each time, I believe the people of America, when they got to 70, 80, maybe 100,000, something to that effect, I believe that the people would have said, we're not giving you an amendment. You're watering our representation down. Build a bigger building. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There you go. And so that would have forced that issue to say, well, then 435 isn't enough. for the population of this nation, right? They never did that. What they did was they just assumed the power. Because they never did this, it opens the door for us to take it back and use technology to actually give ourselves reasonable and actually more appropriate representation than they would ever consider giving us ever again. I believe that, you know, there are reasons why Congress went down this paradigm of saying we're not going to follow the Constitution until they make us. And now's the time, folks, where we can make them, because now we have solutions. Literally, we have solutions for every one of these problems that they've created. There's no reason why we can't have a virtual Congress. We even talked about having, you know, these committees and so forth. They do need to have committees over national defense because that's their job. They don't need all these other committees, but so having these delegations that would go sit in those 435 seats where the majority of the representation would still sit out at the state. So when they finally get into Congress, you know, the final votes may not be based on that delegation you're seeing. The final votes will always be by every representative. But that's how it needs to be, though. We don't need to have everybody sitting in the same room on the same chair. We have technology to harness them and control them. We can control them, folks. They shouldn't be controlling us. Okay. So with that, let's dive into the next amendment, which actually was ratified in 1992, the second article, which is what you were going to read, Sean, but go ahead and read this one, Tammy.
Okay, no law varying the compensation for the service of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened.
Okay, so here's the interesting thing. This law sat there and was dormant. It never got traction. And it wasn't until 1992, and I don't know the gentleman's name, but I've talked about this before. If you do the research on the ratification of this amendment, the 27th Amendment, this will blow you away because you've probably never heard this. There was a student, and I think it was a Texas college, where this student made the supposition that the people could, get an amendment done, that they could actually create an agenda to get an amendment ratified. And the professor basically gave him a bad grade. This was like his thesis or something like that, as, you know, this final thing he did. And so this really rubbed that student wrong, so much so that he went and found that there was this obscure Madison Amendment that was still sitting out there that was never ratified. So what he did was he created a movement in actually ratifying the 27th Amendment, which became the Hillary Amendment. Because Hillary was going to then go into the Congress because Bill Clinton was getting into office. This was really more of a movement to, they utilized this. Oh, I'm thankful you had this when Hillary went into the Senate. But as far as this amendment itself, it was only proof in the pudding that, you know, a person could create a movement to get a constitutional amendment we can use a movement to invoke change. I bet you, neither of you knew that amendment was one, a Madisonian amendment, but you might have known that, but you may have not known. And there's a guy's name, you can actually look it up, who the student was. There you go. And so, you know, when we start looking at the power that we have, when we started our counties and we create this movement, and by doing this, please look at these petitions, folks, because when you start at the county, you're actually using the county as the catalyst in waking up all the other counties, because once you've got one group of commissioners who are smart on this and you have other good counties out there, they get quick on this too, and it starts educating people. It almost spreads like a wildfire, and that's what we need to do, and that's how we do this. Anyway, let's dive into the First Amendment, because we've got plenty of time. And let me see here. Go ahead, Sean, and let's read the first part of the free exercise thereof. Could you go to there?
Amendment 1, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
So they can make no law respecting the establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. Congress. Now, the 14th Amendment changed this, and I want to point this out, because anywhere where you see Congress shall make no law, and I think this is the only one that actually does this, if you look at the 14th Amendment, the states cannot make any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. That applies to every part of the First Amendment, which means it's not just a restriction on Congress. No state can make any law to do this, just like no state can actually, you know, make a law that infringes the right, you know, to bear arms, so forth and so on. Okay, so Congress shall make no law respecting religion, and yet we've talked about how they did this with the Scopes trial, how they did this with the abortion and all of these other religious ideologies that they've injected legally, where the Supreme Court has even injected themselves legally in creating law. That respecting of religion, respecting these, you thou shalt get rid of your Ten Commandments, thou shalt, you know, get rid of any gods before the Supreme Court and any gods before the federal government, which is why it is my it is my supposition, and I purport that the federal government actually established the Antichrist Church. In other words, they created the movement of attacking Christ in creating laws and regulating religion and assuming control over religion and how it was to be taught. This is why I've been, you know, trying to help everybody understand that even though you take your kids to Sunday school, it is not sufficient to fight their Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday school where they're learning godlessness. And I believe that we need to be better at combating what they've been doing by getting rid of the school system altogether. And I know I've talked to Tammy about this as well. And actually, I think I owe this to Sean, but let's not do it at this time. So Tammy, let's pick up the rest of this, the rest of the First Amendment. Go ahead.
Or the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Okay, so to basically click through this, the abridging of the freedom of the press or speech or the right of the people to assemble and or petition government for the redress of grievances. The First Amendment basically says that we have these inalienable rights, and they listed a good bulk of them right there. But when you ask a person, what are your inalienable rights, how many of them remember the right of petition?
Yeah, nobody.
Nobody. Okay, so
I think people have this skewed understanding of the right to petition. They put that together with peaceful assembly, and think that that is what petition means. I've heard people say that.
That's been done by the courts.
Standing out there and chanting at a demonstration is petitioning the government.
So what happened in the counterculture revolution was anarchical. So when you look at the communist revolution and communism itself, I actually say this, that anarchy is a tool for communism, because what they do is they get people out to riot, they get people out to protest, to create disorder, uncivil behavior. What that does is it invokes fear amongst the law-abiding citizens. Who are the typical ones that are, you know, persuaded to do these things are usually the useful idiots. The uneducated are those people that, you know, are too young to be educated. There you go. So when we look at the labor unions and those types of things, they become the useful idiots because most of them may have just learned a trade or what have you. They've never been truly educated. That's where the union has made their appeal to the skills or what have you. And they've convinced people through the lack of education that, you know, collective bargaining is far better than you defending yourself and getting what you deserve. Anyway, so when we look at this, and actually, Sean, let me just say this, because Yay Math, Y-A-Y-M-A-T-H.org, have I ever given you that website?
What was it again?
Yay Math. Y-A-Y.
And yeah, we talked about that a couple of times.
Okay.
All right. It's awesome.
Yeah, so this is where if we dismantle the education system and we get the ability for the federal government to do any education other than the militia, which is what the Constitution demands that they do, demand that they pay for the training in every state to prepare every citizen to be able to, you know, support the Constitution and defend it against enemies, foreign and domestic. So in other words, that's their responsibility to do that, to build our militia system. Therefore, if we abolish the education system, we could have the best educators, you know, and we would probably find that we don't need, you know, a million teachers. We only need a handful of really good ones that everybody can share in a virtual environment. And when you start waking up to this, folks, how much money is spent in this army of ideological educators that want your kids to teach them to become godless and to basically defy you and defy the laws of this land? This insurgency, this orchestrated social engineering insurgency against the Constitution, how much better off would we be by dismantling this entire system and letting this go back to the churches and communities to host, you know, where the kids can go and actually, you know, if they don't have internet at home, they can actually start going and letting the school districts determine what websites or what channels, like yaymath.org is where you're going to get your math. And you got to, you know, turn your things in so that you can actually prove. And then they'll create a testing system, you know, or actually they could pay these teachers, the guy that does Yay Math, to, you know, provide for tests so that they can actually, you know, provide a test or administer a test in either a homeschool environment at the church or what have you. Therefore, we could actually improve and have a superior education system instead of having a social engineered society that is destructive, that would literally kill lots of good patriots and good people, because that's what they're doing. They're out to kill us. And that's not hyperbole, folks. When you look at communism and their takeover, the Khmer Rouge, Stalin, Lenin, and Stalin, or you look at Mao, any of these communist revolutions, even the first failed communist revolution, while it was in its throes, they were chopping everybody's heads off. Anybody who is a threat gets killed. That's what they do. I mean, Charlie Kirk and lots of good people have pointed to these things. We all agree. We cannot allow them to succeed. We have to take this stand, and basically we've ran out of time. So I really appreciate you both coming on. We could probably carry this conversation of education. I kind of went down this rat hole because now we're going to get into the Second Amendment, which will require revisiting Article 1, Section 8, as well as the Second Amendment, because we're going to get into the education system in this next system, or I should say in this next amendment very specifically. So with you having yaymath.org, Sean, then that's great. Then we can actually start talking about what the school system really should be. And it's a part of our governing, law enforcement, all those other things, which would actually heal a lot of our ills and problems. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.